All right, Angela, I think we're ready to go.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this LEAD Network webinar from the Supply Chain Cohort, the title of which is Building a Continuous Improvement Culture. My peer, Helen Lang, and is ably assisted by Marta, is going to talk about the journey of continuous improvement at Innocent. So thanks for joining today. So just as background, I'm part of the committee. I'm an associate partner with an EY's supply chain and operations area. So it's great to be with you today. For those of you that are new to LEAD Network, we're delighted to have you along. The LEAD Network, as per the next slide, is all about how we help advance diversity. A little bit of tech stuff before we launch into a bit more about the background of LEAD. You are able to hopefully hear us now and join through the computer, so hopefully you've dialed in okay. Please put yourself on the listen only mode. We're going to run this presentation now for the next half an hour or so, but at the end of it there is the chance for you to ask questions. So please, by all means, as you listen to Helen's presentation, submit your questions at the bottom. As you can see, there is a Q&A or chat button, so you can ask questions as we go. This session is going to be recorded, so you can share it with your colleagues, but we very much welcome you along. Thank you. Now, on the next slide, just to reiterate, the LEAD Network is very much a collaborative network, but we have to comply with the strict antitrust laws. So in terms of collaborating and sharing information, we're very much restricted. So please respect the boundaries of this group. Thank you very much. So just a little bit about LEAD. We're delighted at the speed that we're growing. The network has got over 6,000 members, 32 large corporate partners, and lots of volunteers part of this group. We're getting new members every month, so it's fantastic to have people along, and we've already got nearly 50 people on this particular webcast. And these webcasts, please share them with your colleagues as well, because we're getting very good attendance of very relevant topics. Essentially, the LEAD Network is all about helping to attract, retain, and advance women in the consumer goods and retail sector. Right across Europe, it's all about connectivity, education, leadership, and business development. We're very much non-profit, it's very much driven by the people that are involved, volunteer-led organization. It's by the members for the members, so we're always very much welcome feedback on topics that you'd like to cover in these sessions, so please get involved. So very much welcome, especially to the new people on this. As per the missions and objectives, it's all around helping us advance and support each other. A platform for exchange of good knowledge, tips, and in particular, this particular group is focused on supply chain professionals. Okay, moving on to the next slide, just a bit of a marketing opportunity here. We get together throughout the year with some really good webcasts and events, and you can definitely get involved and contribute to the steering committee and some of our thought leadership. But in particular, we're delighted and very proud to be putting on this event. It's only about 6 weeks away now. On October the 18th, it's day one of the two-day LEAD Network annual conference. We have a particular event on the first day, which we're delighted to be hosting in Madrid. I'm presenting as well as quite a lot of my colleagues that you can see on this invitation here. If you have a look on the network and register, you can get more information on the specific sessions. What's particularly interesting is a lot of the breakout groups, which are very small collaborative workshops to cover topics close to your hearts. Okay, next slide. Essentially now I'd like to hand over to Helen Lang from Innocent. Thank you, Helen.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. So, hi, I'm Helen, and welcome to today's webinar on continuous improvement in supply chain at Innocent. So I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes talking to you about the following. So I'll tell you a little bit about me. I'll then come on to the approach we've taken to continuous improvement within Innocent, what our experience has been today and how we've affected cultural change, and now how we're thinking about broadening that out to the wider business. I've included some key learnings throughout, which hopefully you'll be able to take away and use. And I'm also joined by a colleague of mine, Marta. And Marta's here to give some perspective through questions and answers at the end. of how the changes have been received and perceived. So I'll be able to answer questions on the things that we've done and what we've put in place, and Marta will give you a perspective of how that's been perceived and how that's been experienced. So with regards to Q&A, I'm really happy to take any questions, but if we could do them at the end, that would be great. So if you've got anything, then either pop it in writing or just ask them at the end, but we'll take all questions at the end. So I'm just going to hand over to Marta now, just to give you a really quick introduction to herself.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. As Helen said, my name is Marta. I head the technical team within Innocent. We are one of the four teams as part of the supply chain of the business, and we're responsible for the quality and safety and also big part of sustainability of our supply chain.
Brilliant. Thanks, Marta. So a little bit about me. So I work for Nestlé. I worked for them for about 7 years. I joined them on their supply chain graduate scheme, and I did several roles for them, the final one being a couple of roles in commercial before I left them. And I left them to come to Innocent, where I've worked for the last 12 years. I joined Innocent doing demand planning for a couple of years, and then I moved back across into supply chain, where I worked within supply planning for about 7 years, working up within that team until I eventually headed it up, and I looked after UK finished goods, European finished goods, and all of our materials. I left that role to go on maternity leave for the second time, and when I came back in October 2017, I came back into the productivity leader role, which is the role that I'm going to talk to you guys about today. So when I was thinking about diversity, one of the things about the role really struck me, in that it was incredibly different to anything that I'd done before. So all my previous roles had been really operational roles, whereas this role was a strategic role. And that required a real mindset change. It required new skills and capabilities. So very, very different experience for me. Previous roles had always been really established, either the role itself or definitely the area. Whereas this was a brand new role, a completely brand new role, completely brand new area to the business. Previous jobs that I'd done, I'd worked either as managers of a team or at least very closely with team members. With this role, whilst I work with broadly the whole of the supply chain, you don't have direct reports or direct peers to kind of bounce ideas off or share experiences with. So it can feel quite alone at times. Previous roles that I'd done, I'd been using proven skills, whereas this role, I had a really good theoretical background from my degree and also a real love of efficiency, but no kind of proven skills to speak of in order to deliver the role. So this was a really interesting question for me in that, well, why was I going to be successful doing this if I didn't have the proven kind of technical skills? And I guess the answer that I came to was, you can learn the technical skills, so you can go on courses or you can read books or you can learn through experience. But actually what I would be able to bring to the role and the reason why I would be successful in it is because my background at Innocent was such that I understood the business, I understood how processes worked, I understood the people, the culture, how to get things done, also how to circumnavigate how to get things done when the business says no type of thing. So that would be what I could bring to the role and why I would be quite successful in it. But I think contemplating all of this, I guess the thing that I came to the conclusion of, it's a really interesting role and a really interesting experience, however, vastly different to anything that I'd done before and very much out of my comfort zone. So you'll have seen that I alluded to the role as a productivity leader rather than a continuous improvement leader. And that's a conscious thing. And I'm going to come on and tell you more about the rationale behind that. But before I do that, I want to just give you some background as to how the role actually came around. So this gentleman is Chris Fielden, and he is our supply chain director at Innocent. And he had seen this role done successfully in other companies. He's also Six Sigma trained, and he also has a really strong continuous improvement ethos. So because he'd seen the success that this type of role could provide companies, he was really keen to bring it into Innocent. I think he really recognised that for it to work within Innocent, we would have to make it fit for purpose for Innocent, or Innocentify it, as we call it. So definitely good to have his sponsorship, definitely good to have his vision. I think without that, it's not a role that Innocent would naturally have got itself to. So having him have the vision for it was definitely a good thing. And also to give you a bit of background about Innocent and the way that we manage our supply chain. So we have an outsourced third party supply chain. So in head office, we have a number of different functions, both within the business and within supply chain, as you would expect, but we don't own a physical supply chain. So we don't own our kit in a traditional sense. So to make you aware of that. Also, another thing that's really, really important for Innocent are the values that we live and breathe by. So these are our Innocent values. And I think for this topic today, probably the one that I would pull from the most would be the entrepreneurial value. So this is something that still exists 20 years into the business creation. And people come to join Innocent because they want to be challenged and they want to challenge the status quo. It's a really fast-paced and dynamic environment. It requires people to kind of to come and experience things and move really quickly. It's a company of bright and talented, clever people, people that want to see change happen. So actually, what we thought about in the beginning was, well, if you try to put something, a corporate principle or a corporate area like continuous improvement with a load of kind of tools and practices behind that, if you try to apply that to the culture that we have in Innocent, it's only going to fail. So at the beginning, we made a really, really conscious decision that we would talk about the role from a productivity perspective. And what we described that as was getting better outputs for the inputs that you put in, making small incremental gains, making small tweaks, small changes. And I think calling it productivity and describing it like that really enabled people to understand it initially and to feel comfortable with it. It felt small and unthreatening. So we knew from the beginning that the vision of it would be that it would be a continuous role, continuous improvement role and area, but that we would start small and that we would bring it into the Innocent ethos. So key learnings at the beginning were definitely sponsorship is key. So having a sponsor that's behind us that believes in this has been a really good thing. And start small and be focused, but have a vision of where you want to get to. So what does the role entail? Well, it's formed of three parts. So the first part is about holding supply chain knowledge. The second part is about generating a project pipeline. And the third part is about designing a continuous improvement program that would work for Innocent. So from a supply chain knowledge, what do we mean by that? Well, our supply chain consists of about 70 people, but in October 2017, there were very few people that had an end-to-end understanding of how our supply chain worked. So people had really good knowledge of their areas, and some had really good knowledge of broader bits, but we really lacked a clear kind of end-to-end understanding. And actually, if you wanted to know about our supply chain and how the whole thing fitted together, you'd have to go outside of our supply chain to our IT team. They'd probably be able to describe our supply chain to us. And we wanted to change that. So the first part of the role was to go out and secure that supply chain knowledge. And in doing so, we also wanted to do different things. So we wanted to try to break down some of those silos and encourage people to think about one supply chain. We also wanted to connect people who were either doing similar roles or who were doing similar activities within their roles so that they could start to increase their learning. We wanted to remove duplication, so where people were working on similar types of things, but again in silos, actually how can we strip those barriers down and remove that duplication? From my perspective, because I can only deliver my role through other people, for me it was about going out and building trust with people as well. So if I wanted to affect change, if I wanted people to work on my agenda, they had to trust me in order for that to be possible. And really also part of the supply chain knowledge was to enable me to go out and to start to challenge some of the things that we were doing. So why were we behaving in a particular way? Why did we have processes set up in a particular way? Was it because of legacy, because someone had handed that down to us? Or was that because we'd made a conscious decision that that was the best way that we could possibly set something up? So that knowledge enabled me to start kind of challenging our supply chain and seeing if there were better ways of doing it. So from a project pipeline point of view, what does that look like? Well, that was about us being able to generate a 3-year waste reduction pipeline. Obviously there would be cost savings attached to it. And there's an interesting nuance around accountability. So I am accountable for Innocent having a 3-year waste reduction pipeline. What I am not accountable for is coming up with all the ideas and delivering all of the ideas. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. Then from a continuous improvement point of view, it was about trying to decide, well, which route are we going to go down? Are we going to choose Six Sigma or Lean or a hybrid or something else entirely? What skill set do we need people to have? And if we want to encourage people to develop that skill set, actually, what approach are we going to take? We talked about the culture already being something that's really pivotal to the success of Innocent. How are we going to educate people, encourage people, help them to work in a different way if we haven't really considered the approach to landing some of these messages? So key learnings from that element would be, be really clear on your own accountability and build that into your language and communications. So being clear of what I was accountable for up front really helped me make sure that we had a pipeline, but it helped me be able to describe to people that I'm not accountable for populating and delivering it. And actually what that then helped was people to understand where my role sat within their remit and their world as well. Helped people to hear that message and really understand what it meant for them. So what did we do in year one? So we made a really conscious decision to put the continuous improvement element on the back burner. And we spent the first year focusing really primarily on the first two bits. So from a supply knowledge point of view, I spent the first 3 months of the role out with virtually all of the 70 people that work within supply, understanding about their roles, learning about the systems, processes, tools, information flows, to get a really good depth and breadth of understanding. That was really helpful because it gave me visibility of things that could go on to the project pipeline, but it also enabled me to get a feel from people as to the things that they thought we should be doing differently, the ideas that they had to transform our supply chain as well. From a project pipeline perspective, obviously I was accountable for generating that pipeline, but we had several problems with that. So we didn't have a consistent way of treating projects, and we were so big as a supply chain, and we weren't very experienced at working collectively as one whole supply chain, that our communication around projects was quite poor. So nobody really found out about projects until it was too late. What that meant for our supply chain was that we spent a lot of time firefighting and a lot of time delivering things that weren't necessarily the best thing for the business, the best solution for the business. They were just a solution that we were able to deliver. So for us, in order for that project pipeline to work, in order for us to be able to generate it, we needed to completely change the way that we manage projects, and we needed to really change people's behaviour. The key learnings from year one would be, building relationships with as many people as possible is a really key thing. As I've alluded to already, the delivery of this type of role comes through other people. So having those relationships, having that trust, etc., is really important. And to be flexible with what you want to deliver. So if we'd gone into that first year saying we want to deliver very strictly X, Y, and Z, then we wouldn't necessarily have given ourselves the time to fix the issue that we found with projects. It's because we were able to be flexible and say, well, actually, this is a big enough thing that it warrants us spending time to fix, and therefore we should do that rather than, no, we must achieve a particular set of targets. So being flexible is definitely critical for me. So it's interesting for us in terms of how we solve the projects issue, because that was the first time effectively we started to change people's way of working. We wanted to change people's approach, and we wanted to start to put less ambiguous approaches into things and really encourage people to work in a particular way. So how we solved that was going to be really important to us. So we developed, we consulted on, and we rolled out a much more efficient way for people to work on projects. And there's a lot of detail that sits behind this particular bit, which I'm not going to go into today. But if anybody does want to know anything about it, I'm happy to pick it up with them outside of this. So how do we go about solving that projects issue? Well, we did several things. So the first thing we did was to develop a really clear criteria for what would or wouldn't be a project. So if your idea hit a set of criteria, it was going to be a project. If it was a project, then we would manage it through a project framework. Now, we call that framework within Innocent our DP framework, so decision point. It's effectively the same as a PRINCE2 framework. So we then also developed a process that enabled people to get their ideas from generation stage all the way through to delivery. That process included really simple tools for communication, so people were aware of all the projects that were going on and could input into them at the right place. We also developed a forum where people would see live project updates and they would be able to understand live risk within our supply chain, but they'd also see future project ideas coming through, and therefore we would be able to choose the best ones. Within that forum, we'd also look at resource to make sure that we had the resource available to deliver what we'd committed, and if we needed to make changes, we were able to do that. We also had a really set of consistent outputs that came out of that project process. So how do we do it? This is a really big change for people. And again, it's the start of streamlining of processes, adherence to an unproven structure. So we had to be really careful about how we approached it to make sure that it fitted with the culture that we had. So we did it in the following ways. We spent a long time designing the approach, about 6 months in total, and that design looked like us taking it to our senior leadership team, taking the idea to our functional lead, so people who have management responsibility within our supply chain. And we went through several iterations of taking the idea, the principles out there, seeking the feedback, refining, etc. as well. Second thing we did was, rather than just put something out there within supply chain that was kind of 70% thought through and we just give it a go and see how it went, actually we wanted to not do that. We wanted to put something in place that had been really well thought through and really developed. So we did a lot of the next level thinking, and what that meant was when we went to present this to people and to sell it to them effectively, we were able to answer some of the detailed questions. Well, what happens if X happens? Okay, well, Y will be the result. Well, what happens if A happens? Well, B will be the result. And that really helped people feel a lot more comfortable earlier on, because there was just a lot less ambiguity around the launch of it. We recognised that we would need resource external to supply chain to deliver a lot of our projects. So, for example, IT resource or financial resource. So we brought those partnering functions on board right at the beginning and encouraged them to be part of the design of the whole process as well. So they came on that journey right from the beginning, which was really, really important. We also recognised that we were going to be encouraging our supply chain to work in a completely different way. So we would need to train them both within the sunscreen process itself, but we were also asking them to be project managers. So not just supply chain professionals, but also people who were able to deliver projects within a project management framework. So we also trained them in that as well. And we continue that training to this day. So any new starters that we have, we will train them in sunscreen and we will train them in project management. When it went live, we were really open to feedback and we changed things immediately when we could see that it wasn't working. So we sought feedback right from the word go and made changes immediately. We also supported the whole rollout process with some really strong communication, and we celebrated successes and made sure that people were really clear about the benefit that this was bringing the whole of the supply chain. So key learnings from that experience would be that big change takes time. So 6 months is quite a long time to spend kind of designing and rolling out something like this. But actually, if we hadn't invested that time, I don't think we would have the success that we currently see now as a result. Second thing would be that embedding change successfully takes really focused ownership. So if we try to do something like this on top of an operational role already, I don't think it would have been successful. The fact that you had somebody creating, developing this, rolling it out, implementing it, supporting it, I think that was one of the key things to the success of this. So having that focused ownership is really, really important. And the final thing is that different people will get on board at different times for different reasons, and that's okay too. So I think you can't go live with these things expecting everybody to feel exactly the same about it. And actually, we had one team within our supply chain that probably wasn't on board until we actually went live and they could see the results. And I think it's just being open to the fact that that's okay. You don't have to convince everybody. You've just got to have enough momentum behind that you can get this thing started and rolling and going. And then everybody will come on board just at a different time. So what had we achieved by the end of year one? Well, from a supply knowledge point of view, we've been able to use the learnings to create some process maps effectively, which we were then able to use for inductions of any new starters. So we were able to describe our supply chain in a way that we'd never been able to before. So that was successful. We were also able to use those process maps to describe our complicated supply chain to external parties as well, which again, we've never really been able to do as easily. So definitely a big tick from that perspective. From a project pipeline point of view, what did that success look like? Well, we effected significant change within supply chain. We had a completely different language that people were working to. We had an embedded process that people understood and were really on board with. We removed a load of waste. So where we had duplication or where there was lots of firefighting going on because people were having to drop their work to help solve project issues, we'd stripped all of that out. People were really clear what projects were on the go, on the pad at any point in time, and they'd input into them in a really appropriate way. So a lot of the firefighting was not necessary anymore. Also, the quality of the end product that we were putting in was much higher as well, again because we'd got the right input in the right time scales. The thing that we were delivering at the end was actually much better for the business, so a lot of waste had been removed. We were able to generate an 18-month project pipeline, which was amazing. So to see what we would be delivering that far out was really new for us, but really good as well. We were able to deliver cost savings, but probably as importantly, we were able to deliver against supply chain commitments. So we were able to commit to the business. We're going to do these things. We will deliver these cost savings. We will behave in this way. And we were able to uphold those commitments. And we were definitely seen to become much more reliable, a better supply chain as a result. Probably my favourite thing is we managed to upskill the whole of our supply chain. So I've talked about it already. They weren't just supply chain professionals. Now they were project managers as well. And to see an entire cohort of 70 odd people be upskilled in that manner and have a safe environment to be able to demonstrate their leadership skills through a project management framework was probably one of the most exciting things to see. And actually, at the end of it all, the sunscreen process was upheld by our CEO as one of a really good example of how to strip unnecessary waste, pointless tasks, etc., out of your day-to-day and the things that you can do with that time back. I think it's something that he's quite proud of as well. The key learnings from the end of year one would be investing in non-operation roles can really pay back. So my role was quite a leap of faith for the business, I think. It's the first role that we'd had which wasn't directly attributed to an operational gain. So I wasn't delivering anything operational. And therefore, it was a leap of faith for us in that you couldn't link my role to an end goal. However, by going through this process for the first year, we were in so much of a better place that actually non-operational roles, giving people the headspace to deliver this type of stuff, you could definitely see the payback really, really clearly. And it's really been quite an eye-opener. Second learning, I think, around this would be that the benefits that you can get from making sure that your basic processes are right are really, really significant. If we hadn't invested the time in sorting out how we managed our projects, we wouldn't feel the momentum that we've got now. So it's definitely worth it. So that's the end of year one. Well, what did we achieve in year two? Well, because we'd covered the supply knowledge element in year one, we focused more on the project pipeline and the continuous improvement bit. So from a continuous improvement element, we definitely focused on implementing a roadmap and a scorecard. So implementing the productivity roadmap gave us visibility of what I was committing to deliver to the business and what the business could therefore expect from me. The productivity roadmap gave me some key metrics that I was able to describe my role to the wider supply chain with, and it really hold them to account. So rather than it being a me thing driving, it enabled me to hold a set of metrics up to people to say, actually, we're in this together. You are as accountable for this as I am. And let's talk about our performance against those metrics. we were able to choose Lean versus Six Sigma. So again, going back to the fact that we have an outsourced third-party supply chain, we're involved in lots of processes within that supply chain. And we made a choice that said, actually looking at the waste within those processes and stripping them out is better for us than looking at the variability within those processes. Hence why Lean was better for us than Six Sigma. Because we chose Lean, we recognised that we needed to educate the supply chain in what waste was and how to look to remove waste. So the way that we affected the cultural change in that respect was to roll out a mandatory training module effectively. And we wanted to do that for several reasons. So we wanted people to be able to challenge the status quo and be curious, why do I do my role in the way that I've been taught? Why do I have these processes that I work with them? But actually, it's very difficult to train out curiosity in people. So actually, if you're able to train people in waste, it gives them a framework. They can apply that to their roles, to their processes, etc. And it will give them a way to ask why. Why do we do things the way that we do? And start to look at waste in a more factual way and be able to strip it out. We also wanted to use the output from those waste training sessions to go into the project pipeline as a way to create more ideas to go after, more resource savings, etc., or better ways to run our supply chain. Because we'd gone down the route of Lean, we also recognised that there were other Lean tools available. So, for example, value stream mapping was something that would be a really useful tool that we could apply. But again, from a cultural perspective, it's a tool that could really put people off. There's process around it. It could take time. So we needed to be really careful about how we rolled that out. So the way that we chose to affect cultural change in that respect was to do a kind of contained trial and error approach. So we practice some value stream mapping exercises, probably about four of them. And we practiced and we have practiced and we evolved and we learned through that. And at the end of those four sessions, we were able to say, brilliant, we're really clear how we can use value stream mapping in a really accessible way to the supply chain. Now we're in a position to roll that out and make it accessible to everybody. We also recognised that once we'd got good at implementing the waste training and the value stream mapping exercises within supply chain, actually we wanted to broaden that out to the wider business. So we started with our partnering functions. So for example, all of our waste training now has key personnel from our partnering functions attending it as well, so not just supply chain people. And actually I ran a value stream mapping exercise on behalf of one of our partnering functions that involved a business-wide process as well. So it's something that they've been able to tap into and to use and to see as well. And also, so that I wasn't in a bubble delivering all this stuff by myself, I also found other people that love continuous improvement as well. So this involved me connecting with people external to Innocent. So finding other people that did a similar role to me and going and talking to them, bouncing ideas off them and sharing. But I also made a really concerted effort to go and find people within Innocent that loved continuous improvement as well and spent time around them generating ideas and approaches and bouncing ideas, etc. So key learnings from year two for continuous improvement would be develop a scorecard and hold teams to account so that it's not just you trying to change the world, it's you together trying to change it. And really find people that love this stuff and go and harness that enthusiasm. It's really, really key. And it really helps momentum and helps buy-in as well. So from a project pipeline point of view, what did our year two look like? Well, I talked about us needing a three-year waste reduction pipeline. Now, we'd got to a stage in the first year where we developed an 18-month one, but there was still a way to go. We needed to get to 3 years. So one of the things that we did was to include this element in our strategy. We recognised that it was so important to us from a supply chain perspective, it warranted going on to the strategy, and that really helped secure the buy-in from people. They could see the senior level buy-in to the principal, and therefore it helps secure buy-in from a total supply chain perspective as well. Because we needed to have a rolling three-year pipeline, we really needed to get a good approach to generating that pipeline. So in year one, we'd gone after the obvious stuff, the low-hanging fruit, the things that were really clear and easy to see. But actually towards the end of that first year, some of the ideas have started to dry up. So in order to have a rolling three-year pipeline, really we needed to find a better, robust way of developing that pipeline approach. So again, from a cultural change point of view, we could have made a choice that said, right, we're going to dictate to the supply chain how they go about generating these pipelines, how they think about it. But actually, we made a really conscious decision to take an experiential approach to this element. So I got together with probably about five other people from supply chain, and we started to design what that approach could look like. So we gave people a beginning. So they've had the waste training. They know how to go and look for waste. And we gave them an end. We want you to be able to fill in this form at the end that tells us what your pipeline ideas are going to be. But we gave them no middle. We effectively said, go away and come up with these pipelines however you feel appropriate. And actually what we then took were all the learnings, the gaps from that approach, and we were able to then develop something that we could use ongoing. So something that we could kind of rinse and repeat every 6 months that said, right, we're now better at how we generate our pipeline. We've got a better approach to it. We then refined that approach by trialing it with various teams within supply chain to the point that by the end of that year two, we had a really solid way that we are going to now approach these pipeline generation principles on an ongoing basis. Key learnings from that would be that inclusion in a strategy really helps drive momentum. So having that backing, it really does give you a lot of kind of carte blanche to go and ask for resource or ask for people's time, and for people to feel better about being able to focus on this. And really the biggest thing I think is that cultural change can be driven successfully by more than one approach. So there's a range of approaches that we've taken. So we've talked about sunscreen. That was a really intense process design, buy-in and rollout. We've talked about mandatory training where it comes to waste education. We've talked about trialing tools before we roll them out and make them accessible to the whole of our supply chain with examples like value stream mapping. We've talked about experiential learning as well. So how we've gone about developing this pipeline generation approach was an experiential rollout effectively. Now, all of those approaches will have their place, but you're going to get different outputs. So for example, experiential stuff, it takes a lot of time, but people feel really engaged. So the end result that we've got in terms of how we're going to generate pipeline stuff going forward, people really buy into it and they understand why they're doing the things that they're doing, but it took a lot of time. Mandatory training, on the other hand, can take a really short amount of time to secure a change, but you've got to be careful how you do it. You've got to do it really well to be able to connect properly with people. So at the end of the year two, what have we achieved? Well, from a project perspective, we've generated a three-year waste reduction pipeline. So we've done that. We've continued to deliver cost savings and other benefits, which is really great. And we've developed and refined a pipeline generation approach, as I've just been talking about. From a continuous improvement perspective, we've given clarity that Lean is our continuous improvement vehicle. We've trained 70 people in waste and how to identify it. We've delivered some really strong time savings through five value stream mapping exercises. We've started to see the shift to a continuous improvement mindset. So I guess for us, we view it as a spectrum. So you start at the beginning of the spectrum saying, I do my role because I understand my role. And if I can bolt on an improvement project to it, then that's great. I think I'm doing well. The other end of that continuous improvement mindset is to say, I'm only good at my role if I'm continually evolving it and continually looking for waste and continually trying to add value. And we're definitely on the journey. We've absolutely started to move away from I'm only good if I do my role and I can bolt something else on. And people really recognize that it is about continuously improving. It's about trying to find waste and strip that out. There's definitely still further on that journey to go. It's definitely about bringing that mindset to life more, but we've made a really good start on that journey. The delivery that we've achieved has been broader than just supply. So we're definitely engaging our partnering functions. They're using a lot of the stuff that they see us delivering and us taking part of. They're definitely taking that and open to doing that within their areas as well. And actually, probably the best thing for me is that across these 2 years, I've been able to demonstrate that actually what we're all collectively as a supply chain doing really isn't productivity. It's bigger than small incremental gains. It's bigger than something safe and contained. Actually, what we're doing is continuous improvement. And towards the end of year two, I was able to talk to our supply chain and say, hey guys, we're not going to talk about it as productivity anymore. We're going to talk about it as continuous improvement. And do you all understand why? And there was lots of nodding dogs in the room, like, yes, absolutely. It's not a big scary thing. We understand that we've evolved into it. And it felt like a very natural embrace of continuous improvement. So it's a really lovely thing to be able to see. So key learnings from year two would be flex between creating stuff by yourself and with others. There's definitely benefits to doing both aspects. They'll give you different outputs, but make sure that you use both sides of the coin. Don't try to do it all yourself. And be open to everyone having an opinion on the work that you create. So for us, for me, everything that we were doing was completely brand new. So everybody wants to see it before it goes live, and everybody wants to have an input into it, which is absolutely valid and really, really welcome. And I think it's important from a resilience perspective to understand what you want to do with people's opinions and feedback, because sometimes it's really appropriate to build in and do something with. And sometimes it's also appropriate to say, OK, that's great. That's an opinion, but perhaps I won't act on it this time. But just to make sure that you have the resilience to be really open and OK with the fact that everybody's going to want to have an opinion, because there is no status quo. There's nothing that's bedded in. This stuff is all just brand new. I mean, it's all conceptual until it comes to life and delivered. So what does that leave us for year three then? Well, there's still loads to go after. So from a supply chain knowledge perspective, it's about revisiting that knowledge, updating it and maintaining it. From a project pipeline point of view, it's about making sure that we've got a really strong waste reduction pipeline, and that on a rolling 3 year basis, we can see those ideas going out to 2022, 2023. It's about embedding that pipeline generation process and getting quicker, getting better, slicker at it, making it a business as usual thing. And it's also about us running a value stream mapping program across some really key supply processes and making sure that we've stripped waste out of that as much as possible. From a continuous improvement perspective, it's about embedding supply disciples. Now, we use the term disciples loosely, but effectively what it means is people within the operational roles within supply chain having continuous improvement on their objectives. So at the moment, you've got me from a top-down approach coming up with these ideas and engendering the change and building new things into our lives. However, actually what we're missing is a bottom-up approach as well, and we want to have people with CI objectives that will be able to bring that continuous improvement mindset to life, be able to look at our processes and tools and systems, etc., and start to challenge on a kind of daily basis, effectively, why are we doing the things that we're doing, and bring some of that stuff to life from the bottom up. So you've got a top-down and bottom-up approach, which will then give us much more momentum. We've gone down the lean route, but actually there'll be many other lean tools that are relevant for us. So actually, what do those look like? How many do we want to use? Do we need to dismiss some of them because we're not a discrete manufacturing company? Can we bring those to life? And if so, how are we going to bring those to life? Again, going back to the culture. How do we bring in process? How do we embed that into people's lives and hearts and minds in a way that they find comfort with? And actually, it's about continuing that journey to a fully continuous improvement mindset. So how do we continue to build that momentum and to really get people's hearts and minds in the fact that it's about continually looking at their roles and improving them? And then really from a wider business perspective, what do we want to do with this? Well, actually, we're getting to the point now where we're really, really proud of the learnings that we've gained from the 2 years that we've been doing this in supply, the approaches that we've developed. And actually, we need to be better at taking that out to the wider business. So beyond just our partnering functions, but actually to other functions who aren't as close to this stuff. So we want to do that in a more kind of formalized way. We also want to be able to agree at a business level what adds value to the consumer, and we want to start to remove waste through that lens. So from a supply chain perspective, we can absolutely look at what adds value to the business from a consumer's perspective, and we can start to strip waste out just within supply chain. But actually, it'd be much better for us as a business if we agreed at a holistic level, we agree that the consumer thinks this adds value, and we agree that we should strip waste out through that lens, not just through our supply chain practices, but actually through our wider business practices as well. Then I think there's also a remit to broaden the disciples principle from just something that we do in supply chain actually to something that we do within the wider business. So how can we have implants within all of our functions that also have continuous improvement on their objectives, where they're bringing this stuff to life and within their teams and their areas as well? So in summary, hopefully you've heard about the approach that we've taken to continuous improvement and what our experiences have been to date. I've talked about how we've used different ways to affect cultural change and the positives about those things, and how we're starting to think about broadening out continuous improvement to the wider business. So I will thank you, and now time to move on to questions and answers.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed, Helen, for that. You're obviously very passionate about your craft, so it sounds like a really interesting journey you've been on. And we've had some questions come in, so let me just pose them to you. Firstly, we have a question from Nicholas. He asked, the structure you articulate seems to have paid back across the business through both tangible and intangible results. What's the biggest challenge or pushback you've faced when implementing the roadmap and the framework?
Good question. I think the biggest challenge is people feeling like it won't work, or resistance to change would be the quickest way to describe it. So I think people can be fearful of change, and I think it's very easy to see lots of reasons why something won't work. So that's probably been the biggest obstacle to overcome, to find different ways to deal with people's objections or feelings or fear, etc. And the way that we've chosen to overcome them would be through several different routes. So it could be different presentations, or it could be different one-on-one conversations, or it could be trialing something, or it could be going live with something to prove the concept. But I think fear of change, resistance to change, would probably be the biggest objection, biggest obstacle.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a few times the journey and the discussion around Lean versus Six Sigma. Mm-hmm. Why? What are the top two reasons why you went with Lean in the end?
The biggest reason would be that we are involved in so many processes that it is obvious that there is so much waste in the processes that we're involved in. So again, third party outsourced supply chain, we've got other people doing this, making our product for us, distributing it, delivering it, etc. But we work with each of them on how they do that. So therefore, there are so many processes that exist that it made much more sense to us to say, well, within each of those processes, these have evolved over 19 years and we've never really looked at them and really truly understood whether they were fit for purpose or not. Therefore, it makes absolutely the most sense to us to say, well, we should start with those processes and strip the waste out. It didn't make any sense to look at those processes and say, well, let's assume that those processes work and just attack the variability within that. We weren't even at the stage where we thought that those processes were the right things for us to be doing. So that's really primarily why we went down the lead route rather than Six Sigma.
Okay, thank you. And just one last question, perhaps should have framed it first. Just in terms of the geographical scope, you mentioned the 70 people in supply chain. No doubt you had wider stakeholders as well. So can you just talk about the geographical scope, and were there any cultural differences that needed to be taken into consideration in that influencing and change journey you've been on?
Yep, definitely. So most of our supply chain sits within the head office within the UK. However, we've got extended supply chains that sit in regions, so in the regional geographic areas that we sell our products in. So they also needed to come on that journey. So we took the approach to make sure that at a group level, we understood what we were doing. So at a head office level, we'd got our ducks in a row effectively. And then we were able to go out to the regional areas to say, look, we're doing this stuff and we think it will benefit you. We want you to also be part of this and to partner with us. There's definitely been a difference in reception depending what geographical location you're talking to. But broadly speaking, we found a way to connect, whether it's through, right, here's your P&L, you'll definitely be able to see an improvement if you get on board with the principles that we're adopting, or your people are unhappy, you'll definitely be able to change that again if you get on board with the principles, etc. So I think it's just a case of us finding what are the key things that each of those geographical areas are looking for and tapping into that and being able to show them how supporting a change will enable them to improve that bit.
Thanks very much. Okay, so I'd be really interested, just Marta, from you being on the journey as well with Helen, it would be interesting to hear your perspectives of the journey and also the, being part of that team.
Yeah, so thank you. So I think Helen summarized it really well. I think the fact that the role is so linked and the function is so linked about change and actually making change, people change perspective, change the way they do things. I think one of the key areas where Helen did a great job and it was really critical to make this a success is not only about people's reaction to change, but it's also about finding that right balance between that reaction to change and actually listening to the feedback. So the fact that, as Helen was saying, that she and her role had to hear about how to implement change in the process itself and how to streamline it and improve it and make it feasible and workable for everyone. How do you find that balance between understanding that people is just reaction to change versus actually they having great inputs and making the process itself to also be streamlined? Because at the end of the day, we were creating a new process and that process could also have a waste on itself. So finding that balance between helping to drive change, but at the same time, listening to the feedback that people had. I think that was a critical part as well.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Marta. So just wanted to say thank you very much, Helen and Marta, for your explanation. Helen, have you got any last points to add to any last tips for people going on this journey?
Just be enthusiastic. I've really, really, really enjoyed it. It's been a real pleasure. And I think if you're given this type of opportunity or you're involved in this type of work, just embrace it and love it and go and do it, because people will get enthusiastic about it. And it's such a good thing to be able to go and implement within a business.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. So yes, thank you both very much indeed for attending and taking us through your story, and for everyone for joining this session. Please, we'd be very grateful if you take a moment to share your feedback with us and also suggestions for additional events. And by all means, look at the LEAD Network site, as mentioned, for upcoming webcasts and also that event that we've spoken about in November. It would be great to see you there. It was a fantastic opportunity last year. Thank you very much indeed, and have a great afternoon.
Thanks very much.